Governor Doug Ducey wants Arizona out of the Ninth Circuit and into a new federal appeals court. But how realistic is this?
It's very difficult to do. If you look at the geography and the caseload, it's been perennial, though, as far as 1970s and coming forward.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, another effort to establish a lieutenant governor for Arizona, debating the level of oversight of bodies left to science,
how observing holy days can affect a business's bottom line,
and Tucson gets international recognition for its food scene.
We're not trying to be a Santa Fe wannabe or Charleston. What we're trying to do is say that the diverse cultures of Tucson really rally around food.
Plus, hiking the Grand Canyon and start your engines.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein, checking Valley traffic on the 303 southbound, a crash at Northern. Also on the 51 northbound, a collision at Coulter has the shoulder blocked. Look for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 73 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, overnight lows in the mid-40s. Sunny skies on the way for tomorrow with a high of 72. Right now, it's 66 degrees.
Governor Doug Ducey has joined the latest chorus to have Arizona moved out of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which currently also includes California, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington. In a letter to congressional leaders, Ducey says the circuit is overburdened with cases. Many conservatives also believe the panel is too liberal. Here's what Ducey's general counsel Mike Liberti had to say.
We're calling on Congress to propose and enact a solution for Arizonans, for Arizona voters, for citizens, and for Arizona businesses that will take Arizona out of a court that is backlogged with cases.
Changing the Ninth Circuit would take action by Congress and would need to be signed into law by the president. Carl Tobias, University of Richmond law professor, follows the Ninth Circuit closely and joins me now. Professor, does splitting up the Ninth Circuit make any practical sense?
First, is there any real need to split the circuit? And that's never been resolved in a way that's very positive, at least by most people who have examined the question, especially members of Congress, but also judges and scholars who study the court. And once you answer that in a positive way, if that were to come to pass, it's very difficult to do. If you look at the geography and the caseload and how that breaks out around the circuit, everyone who's looked at it doesn't think it's a good idea to have California in its own circuit. And it's been perennial, though. I can remember back as far as 1970s and coming forward. It surfaces at various times.
And when it comes to the practical numbers, does the Ninth Circuit actually get overturned more than any other circuit? And if so, are there multiple reasons for that?
Yeah, it may, depending on what you're looking at. If you're talking percentages, I think that's not true, and that can vary from year to year. In overall numbers, I would expect it does over time because it has such a large docket. And so I think maybe something like 15,000 cases a year. And I think probably the next highest after that is maybe 10,000 or so. And so you might expect to have more cases overturned just because there are more cases that come out of the Ninth Circuit than any other appeals court. So I don't know that it tells you very much. And percentages are not very helpful because, for example, some appeals courts may have one or two appeals out of that particular appeals court per year in the Supreme Court. And if they're both overturned, for example, you have 100% rating.
Yeah.
So it's a little difficult to precisely estimate what that all means. But there have been years when the percentages and numbers from the Ninth Circuit have been high. But my sense lately, the last half decade, is they're not very much out of line with a number of other circuits.
As you mentioned, there's been talk about splitting up the Ninth Circuit for decades. So as someone who's a legal scholar who follows this closely, do you expect this on a cyclical basis to pop up? And if so, do you just sort of say, okay, here we go again? Is there any point at which we start taking that seriously?
Well, that's a good question. And part of it is political in terms of the parties. I think historically, at least, the Republican Party has more strongly favored splitting the Ninth Circuit than the Democratic Party. But I think in order to be serious about it, there would have to be an alignment. In other words, both houses would have to be controlled by Republicans and the White House.
Legal scholar Carl Tobias, he's a professor at the University of Richmond School of Law. We've been talking about Governor Doug Ducey's proposal to split the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Professor Tobias, thank you.
My pleasure.
The last time a U.S. circuit was changed was in 1980, and before that, 1929.
Arizona is one of five states that does not have a lieutenant governor. Right now, if the governor leaves office for whatever reason, the Secretary of State takes over. But a bill in the state legislature would change that and have the governor and new lieutenant governor run together as a ticket. The number two position would also take over the State Department of Administration. State Representative J.D. Mesnard is the bill's sponsor, and he joins me. Representative Mesnard, why try to make this change?
So this is, from my perspective, this is really just about good governance. We are one of three or four states that doesn't have a lieutenant governor. We have a very capable Secretary of State, so this isn't really looking at her in particular, and this really doesn't go into effect until after she's done anyway. But what you really need is somebody who's prepared to take over as governor should a vacancy arise. And we've had a number of situations where that has occurred, and the Secretary of State, who does an important job but there's nothing really about that job that prepares you to be governor, has to step in a moment and assume that major role.
What is the advantage in your mind of having the governor and lieutenant governor run as a ticket versus having voters pick each of them individually?
Yeah, there's a few things that are in play. So when voters can pick them in individually, you can end up in a situation where one is one party and another is another party. So for instance, twice we've had situations where somebody who was governor died or got impeached or left, and then it switched parties, most recently when Jan Brewer took over for Janet Napolitano. And that's a huge shift in policy and regime that the voters really aren't planning for. Sure, they know it could happen, but they're not really planning for that. And so it really changes what the voters had in mind. Whereas if you have a ticket similar to where the president and the vice president run together, they know they're getting an administration. If there is a vacancy, there's going to be cohesion during that transition. It's not going to be a radical change. And it can change even if it's the same party, frankly. You get folks who don't agree with each other, and so one takes over and goes a very different direction. And that's really not what we want to see at the head of our government.
This is, as you know, an issue that's been around at the Capitol for a little while now. Why are you thinking that this bill might succeed where others haven't?
Sure. So this is a very different approach than what's been tried. You know, there was an attempt back in the 90s, and then recently, a few years ago, 2010, I believe. But this is differently structured. For one, it conceptualizes this ticket format that's similar or parallels the president, vice president. So something that people are familiar with. One of the issues as well that people don't like about lieutenant governors in other states is what do they really do? I mean, other than wake up, check the paper to see if the governor is still alive, and if they are, they go back to bed. So this actually gives them responsibilities that are meaningful and that really expose them to the breadth of the executive branch. Department of Administration oversees payroll, a lot of regulations within government. So it's a great taste and actual responsibility given to the lieutenant governor. In addition, because they run as a ticket, it addresses the cohesion issue, where if you elect them separately, as some of these other proposals have suggested, you aren't resolving this problem of changes occurring that the voters aren't expecting.
State Representative J.D. Mesnard of Chandler is the sponsor of House Bill 2252, which would create a lieutenant governor for Arizona. The measure cleared its first legislative hurdle today. He's also the sponsor of a proposed ballot measure, which would ask voters to approve the change. It's scheduled to get its first hearing on Monday.
The Arizona Attorney General says willed body donation programs create a public health issue that needs oversight. But a Phoenix-based company is worried that a proposed bill in the Arizona legislature could lead to overregulation of a growing industry. KJZZ's Matthew Casey has more.
Mark Brnovich is proud of his conservative pedigree. He's worked for the Goldwater Institute and is a firm believer that less government is better. But Brnovich wants the Arizona legislature to regulate an industry he sees as part of a public health issue.
When you start talking during the course of this investigation about, you know, severed heads being discovered or, you know, other body parts that were being collected by people, it really is gross. And I don't know if there's a better word that would describe it.
Brnovich is referring to his office's probe of Biological Resource Center of Arizona, or BRC. The state accused BRC of selling diseased body parts and providing them for uses donors didn't agree to. Records show BRC gave tissue contaminated with hepatitis B, or C, to organizations in several states. They also show that BRC provided cadavers to a company that then gave them to the U.S. Army. BRC reportedly cost the Army nearly $1 million because some donors did not consent to being used in a military project. Records show the Army unknowingly used cadavers from BRC for the sometimes destructive process of developing a new crash test dummy. Once allegations against BRC surfaced, the Army quarantined other cadavers. The owner of BRC pleaded guilty last year to operating an illegal enterprise, but this case may only be the beginning. Records show it grew from a joint federal probe that started about 2,000 miles away in Detroit. Similar investigations are ongoing.
We know that today there's really absolutely no regulation. There's no federal regulation. There's no state regulation.
That may soon change. Republican State Representative Gina Cobb recently introduced House Bill 2307. In its current form, it would require body donation companies to renew a state license every 2 years.
We want to make sure that it's safe for the people that are donating their bodies.
The Phoenix-based body donation company ScienceCare has a freezer full of human remains for use in medical research. ScienceCare has been in the Valley for more than 15 years and operates in other states. Melinda Ellsworth is the vice president of donor services. She doubts state regulation would be as tough as getting accredited by the American Association of Tissue Banks, which ScienceCare has been for more than a decade.
And the AATB can come in at any point that they have a concern, at any point, and do a deep physical audit.
And as far as state licensing and the BRC case are concerned,
I don't necessarily feel that additional regulation is required. We have laws on the books that protect the public. We have, in our industry, adopted the AATB as a standard of excellence. Nearly everyone is accredited.
Brnovich says he has no philosophical issue with people giving their bodies to science, but he wants the legislature to mandate that certified medical professionals review donors' medical records before giving tissue to researchers. He also wants regular physical inspections of body donation facilities and a system to track human tissue once it's shipped.
There was recently a Delta cargo flight where 15 human heads were being shipped. No one knew about it, and the only reason why it was discovered by customs because blood was literally dripping from the boxes.
Cobb says if stakeholders agree to policies that protect the public and have all body donation companies follow uniform protocols, then there may be no need for the legislation. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Coming up, we'll join a Sikh community here in the Valley at a traditional practice of sharing their culture through meals.
It's not like a free meal or thing. It's more like spreading out humanity and sharing what you have.
You can break bread with us coming up. It's the show.
Good afternoon. With Mark, I'm Steve in Valley Traffic at this hour. An accident on the 51 northbound near 32nd Street. There's also a collision I-10 eastbound at the 202. Valley weather for the rest of this afternoon. We're going to stay partly cloudy, and we're looking for a high temperature of 73. Partly cloudy again tonight with lows in the mid-40s, and then mostly sunny tomorrow with a high of 72. Currently, relative humidity is at 15%. It's mostly sunny, 68 degrees at KJZZ at 217.
KJZZ is supported by Sun Health Senior Living, a nonprofit provider of destination retirement communities with upscale dining, resort-style amenities, and numerous residence options. Information at sunhealthretirement.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. 30 years ago, the launch of a space shuttle went tragically wrong, ending in the deaths of 6 astronauts and a teacher. The BBC's Chloe Hajimathayu spoke to one of the backup teachers who had trained for the mission, Barbara Morgan.
I remember saying, bye, Krista, bye, crew, and waving, and Godspeed, and you know, I'm so excited for you. I remember thinking, gosh, I wish I were with you.
Challenger now heading downrange.
Seconds after takeoff, a small component on one of the solid rocket boosters fails. No one on board or at the control center notices. And even if they had, there was nothing they could have done. There were no ejector seats and no way to switch off the shuttle's powerful engines.
Engines at 65%, three engines running normally, three good fuel cells.
Just over a minute into the flight, hot gas begins jetting out of a hole less than a centimeter in diameter, but it's enough to have a devastating effect.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
The launch just didn't look right. I know I was probably not understanding everything right away, but looking and thinking, this just doesn't look right, as basically pieces are falling.
As the shuttle explodes, television cameras broadcasting the event to the entire nation catch the expressions on the faces of the families as they turn from excitement to confusion and then devastation.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation.
The crew compartment, which was built to withstand the heat of re-entry, is hurled out of the explosion intact. And it's thought the crew may have been conscious during their four-minute plunge from the sky. But there was no way for them to survive the impact as they hit the sea at 140 miles an hour.
Obviously a major malfunction. We have no downlink.
Krista and Barbara's experience with NASA began in August 1984. With 10 shuttle launches a year, the missions were beginning to feel routine. But then President Ronald Reagan came on television to make an extraordinary announcement.
Today I'm directing NASA to begin a search in all of our elementary and secondary schools and to choose as the first citizen passenger in the history of our space program, one of America's finest, a teacher.
Barbara Morgan was teaching maths to seven-year-olds in a small town in rural Idaho when she became one of 11,000 teachers to send an application to NASA. After she was shortlisted, she traveled to Washington for the next stage of the selection process.
214 of us met, and that included Krista. We all clicked immediately.
What was Krista like when you first met her?
Krista was like the girl next door. She had a very engaging smile. She was quiet and friendly and just soaking it all in. And we were there for a week of workshops and training sessions and a whole litany of interviews.
Krista was chosen as the first civilian who would go into space. Barbara would be her backup in case Krista couldn't make the launch. Finally, after a series of problems delayed the launch, the crew got the green light for January the 28th.
The day of launch was a very, very, very cold morning, and the crew was excited and ready to go. And they'd been training and training and training, and everybody was ready to fly.
Good evening. There's been a disaster at Cape Canaveral. The American space shuttle Challenger exploded only a minute into its flight.
When you saw there'd been this awful accident, was there still a lot of hope that they would have survived within their capsule?
I don't think any of us really believed that there could be any hope of survival. And when we got to crew quarters, we had families in a terrible situation.
You came so close to being the one on that flight. That must have crossed your mind that you ended up being very lucky in the end.
I can honestly tell you that that thought never crossed my mind. I wanted to be there.
That report by the BBC's Chloe Hajimathayu. Tucson's food scene has gotten some international recognition. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, has added Tucson to its Creative Cities Network, but it's the only American city to be on the list for gastronomy. Joining me to talk about what that means is Gary Nabhan, director of the Center for Regional Food Studies at the University of Arizona. Gary, what does this designation mean?
The mayor has established a commission on food heritage, sustainability, and economy that will help guide this and foment both opportunities for tourism-related events, scholarly exchanges with these other cities in the UNESCO Creative Cities Network, and deeper discussion of how we can use food to fuel our economic recovery here in southern Arizona.
How do you sort of get the word out that Tucson is such a foodie city? I mean, it's not, I don't know that it's one that people outside of even Arizona might think of.
Well, we're not trying to be a city of gourmets. We're not trying to be a Santa Fe wannabe or Charleston, New Orleans, or Boston. What we're trying to do is say that the diverse cultures of Tucson really rally around food culturally and economically. 1 in 6 of our jobs here in Tucson are related to food, farming, and ranching. We have over 50 community gardens and church gardens, with our neighborhoods being involved in this. We have city initiatives to use water harvesting to grow food crops and crops that reduce the urban heat island effect. So it's in part this ancient history of food innovation, but we also have incredible vitality in the innovations that are occurring in Tucson today.
It almost sounds like what you're doing is using food as a window into the community of Tucson and sort of the history and almost the soul of Tucson.
You've got it. You know, it's this wonderful fusion between Native American traditions of Tohono'odham and Yaqui, the Hispanic traditions, Western American cowboy traditions that fuse in Tucson, Phoenix, Las Cruces, and other cities in the Southwest. But in Tucson, we're really using that to say, this is how we take pride in our identity, uniqueness, and move ahead. It's not so much that the designation is the stopping point. It's really what we do with this UNESCO designation that interests us here in Tucson. And we're launching the discussion of being a city of gastronomy in Tucson with a food, faith, and climate change conference that will bring people in from around the state to discuss how we can make sure that the poorest of the poor and the people currently marginalized by our food system get more affordable, healthy, and accessible food, so that this designation is really helping the people most in need in our community.
Gary Nabhan is the director of the Center for Regional Food Studies at the University of Arizona. We are talking about Tucson's new designation from UNESCO as a gastronomy city.
In any given week, you can find hundreds of people in Glendale gathering for a free meal. On the menu, an array of vegetarian Indian dishes. It's known as a langar, or free community kitchen, and it's an important tradition with the Sikh faith. But as KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, for many Sikhs here in the Valley, the practice goes deeper than just a desire to feed the hungry.
It's just before 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and the kitchen here at the Nishkam Seva Gurdwara in Glendale is bustling. On one end of this Sikh place of worship, 5 women are making roti. 2 roll out the tortilla-like dough and shake off the excess flour. After that, it's off to the grill. On the other end of the kitchen, 3 giant pots are reaching a rolling boil.
We're going to make a brinjal curry, so we already salted plus the chilies together. And here we are doing like the onion.
Kamalgeet Singh, a local software engineer, is working through one of these pots with a large handheld blender. He's one of many volunteers here who are helping to prepare this meal, which will be served after the day's service.
Most of these guys are coming, like they always come. Like most of the people serve like for 3-4 hours at least.
He explains it's hard to pray and be close to God when you're hungry. But there's more to langar than just the food. The tradition itself is a symbolic gesture that embodies the Sikh value of equality.
Regardless of who they are, where they have come, whosoever goes there, is served food. And this is 365 days of a year, 24 hours of a day, the langar continues.
Dr. Jaswant Sachdev is a neurologist and member of the Sikh place of worship.
It is preferred that people sit in rows, touching one another on the floor preferably, but it is not essential because a lot of people have hip problem, knee problem, they cannot sit on the floor.
Sitting on the floor is another symbolic gesture, demonstrating that no one is of a higher class than anyone else, meant to challenge the old caste system in India.
And the place is open. Not only the people who are here for services will be there, 50% of people who will just come at the time when the food is being served.
Sikhs, Hindus, Muslims, Christians, everybody can come take the food here. Some people might be vegetarian, not to offend them, so that everybody can take the food. In the temple is always prepared vegetarian food.
Bhagwant Rangi is another member of this gurdwara. She explains the langar is a tradition as old as the Sikh religion itself. According to teachings, it began with the religion's founder. As the story goes, Guru Nanak was given 20 rupees by his father and instructed to find a way to turn a profit with the money. Instead, Guru Nanak spent the 20 rupees buying food for hungry people he met throughout the day.
Faith is humanity.
Rangi adds the practice of langar also helps strengthen the bonds between the members of the gurdwara, which she says is important, as the Sikh faith, which is a religious minority here in the valley, has been the target of hate crimes in the past, the most notable being the murder of a Sikh-American gas station owner in Mesa shortly after the 9/11 attacks. Dr. Jaswant Sachdev says people have confused those of the Sikh faith with terrorists in the past due to the outward evidence of the religion, like turbans and long beards.
Quite often, many of us, especially Sikhs, who keep their beard open, are told as Osama bin Laden, go back home and you are terrorist, and all those kind of things do happen here and there.
This is called gulab jamun.
Back in the kitchen, it's almost time to start serving. Again, software engineer Kamalgeet Singh.
It's not like a free meal or thing. It's more like spreading out humanity and sharing what you have.
But Singh says more than anything, this kind of work just makes him happy. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Those of us who live in the valley have generally learned how to adapt to the summer, both the sun's UV rays and the heat. But new research from ASU finds microbes have also adapted to living in this climate. Ferran Garcia-Pichel is a professor of natural history and the environment at ASU and one of the researchers. He joins me. And Ferran, what were you trying to figure out with this work?
This research is about communities of microbes, small organisms that live on the top of the soil. And we've been studying them for a long time now. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I came to Arizona. They live on the dirt and they provide a lot of benefits to the environment. And so we've been studying different aspects of those communities for various reasons. And mostly we were interested in their effects in terms of fertilizing arid lands and also their effects on preventing soil erosion. Those are the the ones we started with. Eventually, of course, once you start looking at things, you discover things that you were not expecting. We discover adaptations of the microbes that live in such a harsh environment, and sometimes those adaptations have consequences.
It sounds like these microbes, in basically trying to protect themselves mm-hmm. against the sun and the heat here, it sounds like they basically turn themselves black, which has the benefit to them of protecting them from the sun, but the detriment of increasing the temperature, right?
Well, that's perhaps a little extreme view on it. Indeed, that is the case, that for their protection, they protect themselves and the rest of the environment also from harmful and deleterious ultraviolet radiation. And at the same time, they increase the temperature. If that is a deleterious effect on the environment or a beneficial effect on the environment will depend on the average temperature. So if the temperatures are very low, then it may be a case in which it's a beneficial effect in that it prevents frost. If the temperatures are already very high, say in summer, for example, then it may have a negative effect because it's already very hot. So it depends on what you're talking about.
So is the next step of your research then to measure the temperatures around these large colonies of microbes to see if they are, in fact, making things warmer?
Oh, we did that already. So that's the basis of our recent contribution, was that we, in fact, could measure those significant differences in temperature. Our research, like I said before, we're not focusing on this. This was something more like we stumbled upon. But by and large, these communities of organisms produce a lot of benefits to the environment. And so our research currently is in two areas. One is in trying to understand some of these adaptations at the molecular level, at the biological level. And the other thing that we have a lot of efforts in our lab now is trying to do some soil restoration by creating microbial nurseries.
Well, given the changes in temperature, are there implications for the rest of the ecosystems around these colonies?
That's a very good question, and we don't know that part yet. I mean, there has to be some effects in that changing many of the basic processes that are important in soils depend on temperature. And just by the mere fact that we are changing or that we're warming up the soil with their presence, we haven't proven yet this, but we can certainly predict that some of these processes will go at a faster pace merely by having higher temperatures in around. And so this effect will probably expand or extend to other areas.
Ferran Garcia-Pichel is a professor of natural history and the environment at ASU and one of the researchers looking at how microbes have adapted to protect themselves from UV rays and heat. Their paper was published in the journal Nature Communications.
Coming up, what it's like to hike the Grand Canyon for the first time.
Is that sign the end of the trail?
Yeah.
Okay.
Get your vicarious cardio for the day. That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic at this hour, accidents on I-10 eastbound at the 202. Also I-10 westbound at the 143, and in the West Valley, a collision on the 303 southbound at Northern. We'll stay partly cloudy for the rest of this afternoon, looking for a high temperature to reach 73, and then partly cloudy skies for tonight with lows in the mid-40s, for tomorrow mostly sunny with a high of 72. Currently, relative humidity is at 15%. It's partly cloudy and 68 degrees at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, helping to improve air quality with about a third of its energy coming from carbon-free sources and with a growing fleet of electric vehicles and alternative fuel trucks. Learn more at srpcares.com.
Good afternoon. With Todd Zwillick from The Takeaway, I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. This week, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has updated its guidelines on depression screening in adults to specifically include pregnant and postpartum women for the first time.
The panel is now advocating depression screening for all new and expectant mothers. An estimated 1 in 7 women experience postpartum depression symptoms, but it's a condition that can also lead to a great deal of fear and confusion for new mothers.
Molly Purrier is a mother of two. After experiencing depression during pregnancy and after the birth of her first child, she co-founded Brooklyn PPD Support. Also on the line, Dr. Samantha Meltzer-Brody, director of the Perinatal Psychiatry Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Meltzer-Brody, and welcome to you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And let me start with you, Dr. Meltzer-Brody. Talk about the importance of these new recommendations and the unmet need here, expectant mothers and new mothers and postpartum depression.
Well, I think this is a terrific and critically important step forward. We've known for a long time that the prevalence of depression and anxiety during pregnancy and postpartum is the highest of a woman's lifetime, in particular the first month postpartum. And so what's really wonderful about this is there's finally the body like the U.S. Services Preventative Task Force that is coming forward saying this needs to be addressed. And my hope is that this will then lead to policy changes.
Now, this may also mean that many insurance plans, including under Obamacare, will start to pay for this screening. But what does it mean in the medical culture, Dr. Meltzer-Brody, that these recommendations are now made if primary care physicians and people like OBGYNs for so many years have been avoiding talking about this and screening for it? Why would they change now?
Well, like anything, there are culture changes that occur, and culture changes can occur for many reasons. Sometimes they occur because there's a mandate that forces the issue. I think that over the last decade in the United States, there has been an enormous shift by most of the professional medical organizations towards seeing screening as important. But now that something like the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force comes forward, this then will allow it to be changed in such a way so that there's no longer an excuse not to screen.
Molly Purrier, talk about your personal experience here. Depression is always difficult. Anxiety is always difficult. As I've been told, I've never been a mother, obviously, but there is an added burden that you're supposed to be thrilled about the birth of your child. You're supposed to be a happy, good mom. If that's not necessarily the case, there's just a huge amount of conflict involved.
Yes. And one thing that someone told me shortly after the birth of my son 10 years ago is that depression and postpartum depression the symptoms are no different. But with postpartum depression, there's a baby involved. So there's no option of hiding under the covers and really withdrawing. My symptoms started, I'd say, in the last month of my pregnancy. And I had trouble sleeping. I was anxious. I had obsessive thoughts. And then things just went from bad to worse when my son was born. And he was a healthy, bouncing baby boy. It was a planned pregnancy. I was just kind of unprepared for the reality. I thought I was going to have these instincts that were just going to kick in as soon as he was born. And I felt adrift right off the bat because that didn't happen. I didn't feel like I knew what I was doing.
Have you found that many of the women in your group in Brooklyn had these experiences compounded by the fact that it was difficult to talk about with their doctor or their child's doctor, or that they were never asked about it?
Well, yes, it's just something that's not discussed. And when I started Brooklyn PPD support, we spoke to my partner and I at the time, we spoke to pediatricians about putting pamphlets in waiting rooms, and there was resistance because it was sort of, there was this false notion, even in the medical community, that if it's discussed, if it's brought up, that it's somehow going to cause symptoms. I think quite the opposite is true, that the less we discuss it, the more scary it is.
Dr. Meltzer Brody, does Molly's experience here sound familiar to you?
Molly's experience sounds absolutely classic. And when we started our program at the University of North Carolina in 2004, we were fortunate to have wonderful collaboration with OBGYN and pediatrics here. But that is often not the case. And it's enormously frustrating to see people suffer. I applaud what Molly has done, and so many women across the country have worked to start advocacy organizations. We don't think it's acceptable for any other organ or disease system in the body to ignore it the way we ignore mental health. So it would never be acceptable to say it really makes us uncomfortable to screen for a heart issue or high blood pressure, so we're just not going to do it. And unfortunately, this is the story of mental health and the stigma around mental health. And then you add a women's health issue to it, and it just all gets magnified.
Dr. Meltzer Brody, one of the blessings of much more widespread depression screening throughout the population has been identifying many, many more people who could use help. One of the downsides has been overprescribing and throwing medications like Zoloft or whatever at a lot of people who don't necessarily need them. I wonder if that's a risk here.
Well, I think that pregnancy and then postpartum and for women who are lactating, there's certain concerns that make overprescribing actually much less likely. And there are some women that absolutely need to take medication because of the severity of their symptoms or their history or whatever it may be that dictates that that's the appropriate treatment course. But there's many other available therapies too. There's all types of psychotherapies. And one of the challenges for our field is going to be figuring out how to deliver care with a broad range of therapies, both psychotherapies as well as medication therapy, in a way that you can deliver it on a population health level.
Molly Purrier, going on that point, I imagine that a lot of women in your group might have thought, I have a problem, but I'm not going to take some drug that's going to get into my baby if I'm breastfeeding. I'm just not going to deal with this. I don't want to take a drug.
Right. That's definitely a concern, and that was a concern of mine. And I did have problems breastfeeding in the beginning, and it wasn't until about 6 weeks postpartum that we really got the hang of it. And so it became something that by the time I was at my lowest point, about 5 months postpartum, I kind of felt like it was the only thing that I was doing right, and I didn't want to give it up. And so I felt like I was between a rock and a hard place. I felt like I needed medication because I had been on it in the past and it had been helpful. But I didn't want to stop breastfeeding. And ultimately, I made the decision through sort of a cost-benefit analysis to go on medication and to continue breastfeeding for another 6-7 months.
Well, we appreciate you coming in and talking about your own experience, as scary as it was, probably a benefit to a lot more people, so thank you.
Thank you.
New recommendations from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force urging that physicians screen all expectant mothers and new mothers for depression. Joining me in the studio is Molly Purrier. She's co-founder of Brooklyn PPD Support, and also Dr. Samantha Meltzer-Brody, director of the Perinatal Psychiatry Program at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
The real estate website Zillow says Valley renters will see a larger average price increase than the national average this year, but analysts also say the rate of that increase is slowing down. Joining me with more on this is Svenja Gadell, Zillow's chief economist. And Svenja, it looks like your forecast for this year is for rents to slow, but not that much in the West. Is that about right?
You know, it depends on where you are. In Phoenix, specifically, we're definitely seeing a slowdown, and you're roughly cutting the rental appreciation rate in half. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, rents are still rising, and it will become more expensive to rent this year than it was last year.
Why is it that the prices are starting to slow down a little bit here in the Phoenix area?
You know, I think, and this story is very similar to what's going on with the rest of the country, we're starting to see more supply actually hit the market. We, you know, during the housing bust, we definitely underbuilt, and there wasn't a lot of rental inventory hitting the market that was new. And, of course, for the last few years, a lot of developers have been building a lot more, but these projects have a fairly long, you know, tail to actually make it to the marketplace. And finally, we're starting to see some of these units come online, and that's reducing some of the pressures on price.
In Phoenix, we've heard a lot about how much of the new inventory is sort of the higher-end luxury-type apartments. Is that similar to what you're seeing in other markets as well?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the new construction that is currently undergoing or is just coming online is high-end luxury rentals. And most developers are not building middle-of-the-road apartments currently. I've heard that that might change this year. However, most of the ones that are currently happening are high-end luxury buildings.
So is that a concern then to the developers and the managers of those facilities to hear that rents will start to, the increasing will start to slow down a little bit?
You know, I think it's something to be fairly expected in the industry. It's a cyclical one, you know, but it's certainly something to keep in mind when thinking about how much more supply do we need at the high end. And some markets can absolutely need more supply, like a San Francisco, I think, is still in high need of more supply.
Given the lag time between when projects are conceived and originally planned and when they actually come online, do you expect to see more groundbroken or more projects approved or thought of going forward now, especially since we have all this inventory out there?
Well, I think there's still a need for more inventory. And keep in mind that even though rental appreciation is slowing, it's still increasing. And I think there's still a need for more supply, perhaps at different price points in the market. But if you consider rental affordability, which is something we follow fairly closely at Zillow, we really have a bit of a affordability crisis on the rental side going on right now, where incomes just haven't been growing as fast as rental increases have. And so I think it's a good thing to see a bit more rental inventory come online to bring those two more into in line.
What do you think is sort of that magic number where folks will look at rental versus buying a home and say, it just doesn't make sense. The price isn't that much more to buy a house. We're just going to do that instead of renting.
Yeah, and you know, I think we're already there. And for us, that magic number it comes in form of the break-even horizon, which is our way to measure how long do you have to stay in a place for it to be financially advantageous to actually buy that place versus having rented that place. And nationally, that break-even horizon for us is right around 2 years. And many places around the country are right around 2 years as well. And so it really makes sense if you're going to stay somewhere for, say, 2 to 3 years, you should definitely consider buying that place versus renting that.
You talked about how it's potentially a good thing that all these units are coming online because it could potentially lower the prices a little bit. Do you foresee apartment rentals or even single-family home rentals becoming more affordable in the Phoenix area in the near future?
No, I mean, I think for the time being, our forecast calls for another 1.4% increase in rental rates for 2016. So I think, unfortunately, rents will continue to climb, albeit at a relatively slow pace. And that gives incomes a chance to catch up a bit more. But for the foreseeable future, I don't think rentals will get significantly cheaper anytime soon.
Svenja Gudell is chief economist at Zillow. Svenja, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Sunny skies over Phoenix, 68 degrees at KJZZ at 251.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering a gourmet game plan with gridiron subs, party platters, USDA prime steaks, fresh-made guacamole, and craft beers. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
There are a number of well-known national companies that are closed on Sundays, like Chick-fil-A and Hobby Lobby. It's also becoming more common for local businesses to give their employees, quote, family time. Some car dealers are closed on Sunday, and one local dealer has recently started advertising the fact that it's owned by Orthodox Jewish people who close their business on Saturdays and reopen on Sundays. So how does that affect owners and customers? With me to explain is ASU economist Dennis Hoffman of the W.P. Carey School of Business. Dennis, is there less pressure on a national chain if it closes on a certain day, whereas a mom-and-pop store may need to be open on that extra day to bring in enough money and also trying to bond more with their neighborhood customers?
It's clearly the trade-off. If you choose your restaurant, you choose to be closed on a weekend day out of deference to the Jewish faith, let's say a Saturday, or the Christian faith, say a Sunday, what the balancing act would be, do you lose more folks that are kind of indifferent to those days of rest or indifferent to those preferences? Do you lose more business to those folks than you actually pick up by, sending positive signals to those people that very much respect your choice of a day of rest?
So does the decision end up helping businesses?
Some people do want to take their business to like-minded individuals. And if you are of a religious faith where you believe that, we should have a day of rest, either a Saturday or a Sunday, and you find a merchant that sells, that shares that same belief by closing their doors on the Saturday or Sunday, I do believe that for some folks, it's clearly the case that they will frequent that business, and they'll frequent it. Go out of their way to frequent that business on the days that they're open. The unknowable here, Steve, would be, how much business do they lose from those people that are more or less indifferent to this particular strategy, and how much do you lose by not being open?
As consumerism has changed, as more people are working different schedules, they may need businesses to be open 7 days a week. So has that had a significant impact?
I think it definitely has. The town I grew up in Western Michigan was very religiously conservative, and everything was closed on Sunday. I think we had the only McDonald's in the world that was closed on Sunday in my hometown. So what we had, though, back then was we had very traditional families. We had one working spouse. We had one spouse not working outside the home, and they were able to engage in the requisite commerce, during the work week, and take that day of rest on Sunday. Very, very different today. We have so many choices. We have lots of work going on in the household. Typically, both spouses or everybody's working at strange hours, needing to take days off at odd times during the week, maybe having to work both Saturday, Sunday, and then taking days off during the work week. Really a very different mindset, different mentality today than what we saw traditionally.
Dennis Hoffman is an economist and a professor at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Dennis, always nice to talk with you. Thanks.
Great, Steve. Have a great day.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Cameron, and today I'll be racing my two-wheel drive buggy. It's almost as if it's like an off-roading car, just shrunk down to a tenth of the size. And instead of being in it, I'm up on the driver's stand holding a remote to control the car. My brother actually introduced me to this when I was about 10. We broke our car in the front yard and we went to our local hobby shop to fix it. And we saw them racing, and the next day we were back joining in on the fun. Some people take this as like a career in their life, and hopefully I can do that when I'm older.
That's Cameron Ayers racing remote-controlled cars at Scottsdale RC Speedway. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we should pull over, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Each year, more than 5 million people visit the Grand Canyon, but only about 1% of them make it to the Colorado River at the bottom. An even smaller percentage of those visitors are Arizonans. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry has lived in Arizona almost her whole life and never thought it was possible to hike it herself until recently.
I trained for a year and a half for this. I've never done something this physically demanding before. I've never been athletic, and as someone who's fat, I feel a ton of self-consciousness. For me, this was as much about facing my fears as it was about hiking the canyon.
It's really hard to think of things to say when you see it. I feel so small.
As I stepped onto the Bright Angel Trail, I felt my shoes grip onto the icy ground and these hand-warming packets become fully activated in my gloves. My friend and coworker, KJZZ reporter Sina Sieg, asked me if I wanted to hike the Grand Canyon with her. I said yes, assuming she would never follow up on it. Then she did, which is how I found myself hiking a steep path down to the bottom.
But you're like really close to the edge, and I'm kind of impressed.
Thanks. I'm kind of impressed too. I honestly expected to have like a partial nervous breakdown before we started.
But I wasn't just scared. I was excited too. I had never been below the rim of the canyon before. As the sun moved through the sky, the canyon walls changed colors, glowing in reds, oranges, and purples. And it felt like walking through four or five different landscapes. Parts felt like high country, others like the desert I'm used to, or the woods or the beach. After 6 or 7 hours of hiking, I was starting to feel sore and tired.
We're really close, hopefully half a mile to three quarters of a mile from Phantom Ranch, and I can hear the river, and I'm really excited to get there.
After 2 days at Phantom Ranch, a lodge at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and a long but leisurely extra day of hiking, I could no longer avoid thinking about the inevitable.
And right now, my stomach is just a little unsettled because I'm really nervous about hiking out and feeling my own limitations, but also feeling proud that I'm pushing myself. Hopefully I'll do this again, but even if I never do, this was enough.
Those 9.5 miles up were no joke. I managed to stay focused, though, and we even started making better time than I thought.
It's good. I was feeling so intimidated, and I feel pretty proud of myself now. I'm pretty excited, and like, you know, maybe I'm capable of more things than I thought I was, which is kind of cool.
I even maintained a positive mindset till the 1.5 mile rest house, the last stopping point on the way up to the rim. I know I'm gonna have to dig really deep for this last 1.5 miles, but I feel ready to dig deep. And then,
I think realistically, we have less than 1/2 mile to go. Definitely. Probably less than that.
I'm like, every step feels agonizing.
Where's that optimism from the 3-mile house?
I think it's still there.
It started to get dark. We were the last ones off the trail, and it felt like the end would never come.
Is that sign the end of the trail?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. We did it. I didn't think I was strong enough to do that.
After 3 days of hiking and a total of 33 miles, I felt amazing. I realized that it didn't matter that I finished last or that it was so hard. It mattered that I did it. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News.
And thanks to Stina Sieg for her production assistance on this piece. Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on the show. Construction on some light rail lines may be sped up, and Canadian companies are outsourcing to Arizona. Those stories and a whole lot more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. Our news director is Al Macias. And our executive producer is John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Good story ideas, etc. The show at KJZZ.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. Thank you so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.